feel like we ought to start with just like a real lengthy silence to duplicate the rain delays. Maybe some intermittent showers.
Yeah, what would be like, so I was talking
to Colton. What would be the podcast delay?
Yeah, that's a good point. I was talking to Colton in the clubhouse about like ways to kill time. Mm-hmm. He said when they were in
listening to this podcast.
Oh, dude. And he said back in Memphis they would sometimes go on the tarp and slide on the tarp, you know, head first.
Superman.
Yeah. Like, I have images of Rick Dempsey doing that. So I don't know what the podcast equivalent would be. What would be the podcast delay? Like, rain delays a baseball game. Mm-hmm. So what delays a podcast? Me talking?
Buffering?
Yeah. Making bad
buffering.
Jokes.
Yeah. Buffering. 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 Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined as usual by St. Louis Post-Dispatch sports columnist and all-around man about town, Gadfly, if you will. Would you like a Gadfly?
Yeah.
Gadfly Benjamin Hockman. We're recording this in what is expected to be perhaps another in a series of rain delays or postponements. The Cardinals already have had three rainouts, postponements in April. That doubles the total of April or March rainouts in the Busch Stadium 3 history. So 11 years of the ballpark, the previous 10, they had three total postponements in March and April. Already this April, they have three. They're hoping to get this game in against the Reds. You're hoping to get a column in to the paper. What do you think this has done to the biorhythms? I mean, my sense is that they're going to probably pay for this down the road. We already saw how like a doubleheader can really kind of futz with their rotation and their pitching, and it's almost like Saturday's postponement against the Reds, that would have been game two of the Reds, that postponement bought them a day that was necessary to keep their rotation on turn. What do you make of it? Good, bad, indifferent?
Right. And you throw into it, Derek, the idea of just they were winning games. For a change, they're winning a bunch of games, and now they had to sit out. We're doing this on Sunday, so they had to sit out Saturday, and that delay looms. But yeah, so and a guy like Old Leaker, Mike Leake, who's scheduled to pitch today. The one thing about him is his teammates say he's kind of like a chill dude. I think it's a scouting report. Chill dude. The type of guy that wouldn't let this really get inside his head. But the question isn't just about the starting pitcher. It's about the relief pitchers, too, and how they handle it. And we saw earlier in the season with the rain delay, was it the Cubs series? The first week of the season, there was some, you mentioned biorhythms, where things just kind of got off base because of some delays, and it affected the performance of the pitchers.
Yeah, I mean, early on in a season, a bullpen is looking for work, looking for action, and looking for roles. And this bullpen, as unsettled as it's been, you know, one of the reasons why is not just because of that first week, but it kind of had a herky-jerky spring training when you look at Cecil trying to be prepared for Team USA and a possible call-up to the World Baseball Classic. Sungwon Oh approximately circled and navigating the earth twice during spring. And
the Jules Verne book?
Around the world in 80 days.
Sungwon goes around the world in 80 days. Around 80 innings. I don't know what I'm talking about. Around the World Baseball Classic? That's not bad.
Buffering. 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 Some of the guys were just kind of looking for their rhythm, and they, you know, I talked with like Jonathan Brocks and a few of these other guys, and they said they needed like almost regular work to find the feel for their pitches. You know, that was certainly true with Tyler Lyons, but obviously true with Brett Cecil, who in the course of just four podcasts has turned his season around and started to look sharper there. So yeah, I mean it's interesting. You know, the rains come and everything kind of throws off. It looks like they're going to have a stretch either in June of many days in a row where they have like a one game series here at Busch Stadium before vamoosing out to Arizona. The Reds would have to come from New York to make possible, or then you're looking in September when rosters are expanded, and maybe the Reds are better, who knows, but they could then play a doubleheader that day, which we've also seen before where we had a trip to Pittsburgh a few years ago where it was five games in 4 days, and just it's like, all right, well, that's where a lot of the division will be decided. Mm. What I find interesting about this is not just the postponements, but this homestand. So this homestand sets up, which continues with a four-game series for Milwaukee and better weather, you'd think. But sets up for a. You were knocking on wood.
Yeah, I don't like the rain delays. So I want to knock on wood and make sure there wouldn't be a rain delay.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, the world thanks you for your efforts in holding off the rain delays.
Sorry to interrupt the podcast, but I thought that was for the better of all of us.
No, I just...
Greater good.
It's radio, so you want to describe what you're doing. As opposed to, like, your mom knocking on the door while you're recording a podcast.
Right.
So...
Mom!
The homestand set up for the Cardinals to make some real hay in the standings. I mean, you know, they had the moribund Toronto Blue Jays come in, had the fewest wins in baseball. You know, they come out of that series exactly where they ought to have been. They sweep the doubleheader. They're 11-11 through 22 games. They get a mulligan, and they move on from there. You know, then they beat the Reds. They're in a position to win that series if they play that game. Now they are in a position to win both games. Then Brewers come in for four games. You take three. All of a sudden, you're starting to put some distance between 500, you know, and themselves. And I think that's what this homestand sets up for, because I've been asked, you know, well, does this put them right? Does this say they're right? It's like, well, no, these are the games they should win. Mm-hmm. This is their chance to not settle for 500. Whether or not you know this team is right or not comes in the next homestand when the Cubs come to town. Right. When the Boston Red Sox come to town, and when the San Francisco Giants come to town, that's the homestand where it's like, all right, well, what are the Cardinals?
Yeah, that's a good point. And we talked about it on the previous podcast with the Cubs pitching. We're seeing it this year. I mean, the Cardinals are 500, and they're right in the mix in the division right now because the Cubs are the 2017 Cubs. They're not the 2016 Cubs. Maybe their pitching isn't as strong. Again, a lot of baseball to be played. But and I think a theme, though, as we look at this Cardinals team, that they're winning games lately, which is exciting. And a friend of the podcast, Ben Fredrickson, had it in his online piece on STLtoday.com the other day, just the idea of, like, are the Cardinals sweeping their problems, i.e. fielding and base running, under the rug because now they're finally mashing. And now they're driving in a bunch of runs, and we saw it in dramatic fashion, of course, with Matt Carpenter on the walk-off extra innings grand slam.
Right, so that was what won the first game of the doubleheader. A rainout pushed a doubleheader to Thursday because Toronto's only coming to town once every decade, it seems, so they had to get those games in. Doubleheader, you know, they score eight unanswered runs in that game, in that first game, capped off by Matt Carpenter's grand slam. It is very easy to latch on to that and almost, like, force hindsight on it and say, well, that's the turning point, right? That's what everybody wants to ask. And in fact, you know, you have the questions like, could this be the kind of thing that ignites a team? Well, it could be the kind of thing that won a game for a team, because it just did. Right. But as far as igniting a team, it's probably the more, like, universal picture of the offense getting good. But I wondered, I mean, you saw ghosts of seat cushions past in that grand slam, right?
That's right, yeah. One of the fun things for me being back in St. Louis as a columnist, I am from here, but I came from Denver, is that memories of the past can kind of come into the present. And a lot of people remember, and if they don't, the 30 Aprils ago, seat cushion night at Old Busch Stadium. And basically, and you had it in your article that... the Cardinals got Matt Carpenter hit a walk-off extra innings grand slam, and the last time a Cardinal had done that was 30 years ago, and it was Tom Herr. And sure enough, it was the famed seat cushion night where 40 plus thousand people were given these white seat cushions, and as soon as Tommy Herr's ball went over the wall, 40 whatever thousand seat cushions were frisbeed onto the field, and it made for a really cool image and a rare image, you know. A rare image in baseball, these fans. And Jack Buck even made a joke on the air saying, well, I guess we can have seat cushion day tomorrow, since they just gave us back all the seat cushions. Yeah. We can give them back the next day. And it was neat, you know, the 30 years thing. And then, of course, both guys were age 31. Both guys were popular infielders. Both games were crazy comebacks by the Cardinals. So I wrote about that in the Sunday newspaper for the Post-Dispatch. And then also the idea, and we were talking about this off air, that both teams won a few games right after that. And the irony, or I never know if I'm using the word irony accurately, by the way. And then Alanis Morissette ruined it for a lot of people in my generation as well. But follow me if you may. The irony,
jagged little pill of a word.
Yeah, yeah. The irony of this is, you know who hasn't gotten a hit lately is Matt Carpenter. He hit the Grand Slam. He's 0 for his last 7. He hasn't gotten a hit since the Grand Slam. But the Cardinals have been winning, and so it was an important win, like you said. I mean, they had lost the current Cardinals had lost the previous night in 11 innings in
2 days before,
or 2 days before, in just one of the most frustrating games for fans. I believe there are 4 errors and some blown stuff from the bullpen.
Toronto scored 6 runs, 5 of those runs related directly to errors.
Unbelievable. So they blew that one against a team that
one was a hard luck error, though, because Piscotty, I mean, great throw from right field happens to hit the runner in the noggin.
Good point.
We call that karma.
Oh, yes. That game was frustrating. So for them to go into the extra innings again and finally win one, that was huge. And then to come back the next game, suddenly it's like, oh, my God, they swept the doubleheader. Everything's fine. The Cardinals are the greatest team in baseball history.
What did you, looking back in the 87 team, then what did you see from seat cushion night forward? Was it some sort of ignition switch? And were you there that night, or do you claim to be there?
I was not there. That's funny you mentioned that, Derek, because on Twitter I asked, were there any people that were at the game? Thinking, you know, 1 or 2 people. I mean, it was 30 years ago, and dozens of people were saying they were there. I'm like, are you, like, I really had to vet the people that I was that I ended up interviewing for the story to make sure they were there, because it sounded like everyone was there. The whole 3 million people were there that night.
Take me through the vetting process. How did you ask for proof of a ticket or?
Yeah. I contacted Busch Stadium and I got security footage from that night. And of all,
he was asking like a legitimate question, and you're going to take it in a goofy direction.
Oh no! I mean, I just meant like, I really pressed with my questions, like, where were you sitting? What were your memories? Like, that really had them talk it through, because I didn't want it just to be some joker that wanted to get his name in the paper.
Oh, and when they said like, well, you know, I was sitting in Cardinal Nation in Ballpark Village,
right.
I was overlooking Clark Street, then you're like, no.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I was not there. I was 7 years old at the time. But yeah, that was a really exciting season. But another thing to point about the game, the seat cushion game, was Tommy Herr got the home run. But a guy like Tom Pagnozzi got his first hit in the major leagues in that game as a key hit. That was a team game. And what we saw from that 87 team was they were decimated by injuries all year. I mean, the reason Pagnozzi was even up was because they had just traded for catcher Tony Pena. He breaks his thumb, so now they call up Pagnozzi. He's the backup catcher. That was a team win. And that team was famous in Cardinals lore for team wins. It wasn't like they just had one or two big mashers in the middle of the lineup doing all the production. And they ended up winning a bunch of games that April, and they defeated the Pond Scum Mets by 3 games in the Eastern Division that year. So you look at the win that the current Cardinals had a few days ago on the walk-off extra inning Grand Slam. Sure, Carp was the hero, but it took a lot of other heroics from a lot of players, notably Randall Grichuk, to even get to that point. And that's the kind of thing when everybody can stake claim in the win, that's a good thing. It's like, it's not like Carp won it for us. It's like, we all won it together, and Carp got the final play.
Yeah, there was a lot there, and I wanted to ask you that, is do you see similarities? Because the word that was used in the wake of that between the two games of the doubleheader, and then even after the second game, after they completed the sweep of the doubleheader, was this idea that it was team wins. Do you see some similarities in how 87 went about baseball and maybe how 17 ought to go about baseball?
Well, the 87 team actually could run the bases, so that's a difference. but no, you're absolutely right. I mean, a guy like Jed Jerko, for instance, I mean, we entered this season, we knew he would get a 300-400 at bats. But now, if, I mean, Peralta, and you reported yesterday, was dealing with some issues because of medicine that were fatiguing him and making him not the player he thought he could be. But even so, plugging in, next guy up, the whole thing. And there's something cool about that when it is, you know, you used to cover basketball. I used to cover basketball too. It kind of would get routine. Like every night, same guy scores 30, the other guy scores 20, and those are the two guys that are good for your team. But when you've got everybody, 25 through, making contributions in key pressure moments, there's just something about that, and they feed off each other. And talking to some of the Cardinals in the clubhouse, you know, it's cool to hear. And coincidentally, talking to the St. Louis Blues about this too. They're in the playoffs right now, and they're talking about how they feed off each other. And, you know, Jim Leland, I believe, once said chemistry is just a class in school. And we could do a whole other podcast about how important or not important chemistry is.
I think we did one.
Yeah, I think we did one. We did one. Let's look back in the archives. But I think these are some nice signs for the current Cardinals.
This is kind of what I wanted to get into with this episode. We spent a lot of time talking about pitching and the true standings in the last episode. We'll have all season to explore individuals, but this notion of where the lineup is right now, I think, you know, that is sort of the underpinnings of their route back to 500 and then their push past 500. It's like you mentioned, Ben Fredrickson asking in the question as to how much offense do they need to overcome to kind of mask some of these other issues. And I'm not sure that this is going to be an offensive juggernaut team. It still is going to be the team that we described at spring training as OBP based. And, you know, what direction they've gone in with the lineup, there were some hints of that during that rally. You know, you mentioned Grichuk off the bench with a hit with runners in scoring position, something they have not done, something that even later that day they went 1-for-15 in a game that they won with runners in scoring position. You know, then you have Grichuk with a home run, you know, to tie the game. That's what he's off the bench into the lineup, and he hits a home run, a key home run. He's looked better at the plate. He's started to see some things from Milwaukee while they were in Milwaukee all the way now into this series, and he wasn't jarred by not starting. You know, he knew he wasn't going to be in the lineup after Martinez has a good game the day before with his two-run homer to try to push the game, you know, and take the game back from Toronto. But you could kind of see what's developing with Grichuk, and then of course you have the grand slam. But what started the grand slam was a triple from Colton Wong, a leadoff triple from Colton Wong, who has really kind of made the eighth spot his home. What could that mean for, I mean, when you look at, not, I guess when you look at the lineup through the eyes of Colton Wong and what he's done here recently, what do you think that means for what the offense could become?
Well, and you and I both just spoke to Mike Matheny at the pregame press conference and got some quotes about Colton's approach at the plate and his confidence. And I feel like we're always writing about his confidence and such. But yeah, I mean, at worst, if Colton Wong gets on base, which he's been doing lately, it was one way or another, it flips the lineup because it gets the pitcher up, and that means the next inning, high priced free agent Dexter Fowler, who is Mr. OBP. Maybe I haven't asked him, but I know he's working on his doctorate. Dr. OBP. He's on target. That's dumb.
Buffering. Buffering.
But it flips the lineup, and it gets Dexter at worst leading off the next inning. And we talked about this a lot in every element of our jobs about how Colton Wong can be very important to this team if he embraces that eighth spot, and then because he also provides speed and hustle, and yeah, he gets picked off base, which is, you know, frustrating and mind-boggling to some, but the reality is lately he's getting on base and he hasn't been that bad defensively. I feel like he could he knows he could be better, and you look at some of the UZR and the defensive runs scored, defensive runs saved stuff that I was looking at actually just last night. He's actually
just for kicks.
I couldn't sleep.
Bedtime reading.
I couldn't sleep, so I was just, you know, going through Twitter. Yeah, he could get better, but I think he will because he's Colton Wong. He's a pretty darn good fielder. He's the only game changer they have from a glove standpoint in the infield. So, yeah, it's pretty cool how if Colton can keep this up, again, how many times have we said it? Small sample size. It's only April 30th. You know, tomorrow, it's going to be May.
Do you know that reference? It's from
yes, okay. Yes.
So, it's small sample size. But the fact
do you not? I mean, is that something that you like have to? Why do you have to turn to me and go? Do you get that reference? Do you think what? Here's what do why. You do? You think I live within a little bubble that has 108 stitches and I don't see out past that?
I see what you're saying. I don't think the average person, average 41 year old, knows NSYNC songs.
Just because I don't choose to regurgitate and recite memes doesn't mean I don't know them. It means that I make the conscious choice not to use them.
I just wanted to make sure that it was a pick my poison. I made the stupid little joke, mm-hmm. which I thought was pretty clever, and I stand by it. But then I was like, either you're going to be like, what was that? And I have to explain it, because that means you wouldn't have known it. Or I wanted to make sure you knew it, and I, you know, tentatively asked you.
It's Justin Timberlake.
Yeah.
And it has to do with a odd pronunciation of my. Or me.
Me. Yeah. So it is a small sample size. Tomorrow's May.
Like your jokes all are.
Right.
We have a small sample size of your jokes.
Good ones. Yeah. So, if Colton can embrace that eighth spot and get on base more, you know, That's pretty exciting.
He already has 4 intentional walks, which is a career high. Intentional walks are part of the game when you are batting eighth. You know, they're going to try to pitch around you, you know, but so are intentional walks and knowing what to do with them. I think one of the things that we saw already in this homestand is exactly what you're describing, the power of turning over the lineup. So Colton goes up there, takes his walk, maybe the inning ends or maybe they go to a pinch hitter or whatever. But then you have Fowler coming up either next or to lead off the next inning. And Fowler, at one stretch there, got on base 9 out of 11 times. And you're starting to see the familiar Fowler show up. Not the guy who was there in Washington or Yankee Stadium, who was clearly struggling to pick up the ball, was more aggressive, was, as Mike Matheny said, aware that maybe the only pitch that he would get to hit or only pitch to recognize he would hit was the first pitch. Then all of a sudden he's in bad counts. I mean, there were times like he just looked uncharacteristic. This is a guy who is comfortable hitting deep in counts. That's his identity. His identity is taking walks and working pitches, and there was very little of that. Until we saw in this homestand, he figured out some mechanical things. He started working through, you know, some of the things where he could get a clearer sight from the left side, and be more aware of, be better at picking up the pitches so he could get back to his roots a little bit. And then he took off.
Yeah, he's 9 for 18 so far in this homestand with 2 home runs, and both those came, if I recall, in the same game, an exciting win against Pittsburgh. Yeah, there's no question that finally we're seeing the guy that we wrote thousands of words about in the winter, and then we all got excited because here's a new thing to write about. Cardinals OBP, they already had one of the best on base guys, and now he's going to be their third hitter because now they've got arguably the best guy coming in with Dexter, and Aledmus, I think, could do a little better this year too.
He's in that 220 range, but it doesn't feel that way. It's interesting, like you watch him and then you check the numbers and it's like, wait, this doesn't quite line up.
Yeah, and he basically, like, from an offensive standpoint, single-handedly won that one Saturday game. So you're like, oh, he's doing well, right? He won that game for you. They were 3-9, man, and I know they were playing really, really good opponents, and we can't.
They were playing really, really bad baseball, right, against good opponents.
Yeah, exactly. Both things. Like they could have been playing good baseball, but the opponent was still really good. But not only that, they were playing good opponent, and the Cardinals were playing terribly.
Right.
And so it was a bad recipe. So it's just, for lack of a better word, neat that things have been rejuvenated and we've got some stuff to write about.
But let's put an asterisk by it, though, because four errors against Toronto, miserable team that's playing miserable, that has very little offense, that came in here as one of the real peers of the Cardinals in poor offense.
Right.
You know, it took the Cardinals gifting them four errors and five runs, and the Cardinals lost that game. You do that to any team, and you're going to lose. You do that one error and a gift of one run or two runs to a good team, you're going to lose that game. So we need to kind of allow for the fact that, yes, the Cardinals did well in that series in Milwaukee. They kind of got their foothold there and then have come home and played better. But even in Milwaukee, the quality of the opponent allowed for the Cardinals to have some wobbles that other opponents won't. And that's sort of what I mean by, hey, you got to beat the teams that you're better than. Mm-hmm. That's what the Cardinals are doing this homestand. You got to beat the teams that are better than you. That's what they have to do at the next homestand.
Yeah, and we're going to learn a lot about it. And it's funny, I don't know how far into this podcast we are time-wise, but we haven't even really talked about starting pitching yet.
Well, no, that was when I presented the idea that we would talk about the lineup. Mm-hmm. That was my idea.
But, yes, touche.
Okay.
But, it's interesting that we've gone this far. And, of course, the starting pitching has really, for the most part, been good.
That's the edge, yeah.
And that's given them the edge.
But they need help. They do need help.
How do you think they'll handle it? To quote the old Jim Murray, there was O.J. Simpson from USC, and I believe it was Gary Beban from UCLA were the two best players in college football this particular year. And he wrote, they might as well just send the Heisman out here to L.A. with two straws. So you think they'll just send
us... What? Two straws?
Yeah.
Is there a Heisman drink?
Come on, man. It was the idea they can just share the Heisman, like a malt drink at a shop.
Like at the old soda fountain? Like they're going to a sock hop and they're on a dance?
Basically.
Or a date?
Yeah. So that's an old line that I liked.
It makes no sense. The Heisman isn't a drink.
But it's a saying. Send it out here with two straws. They can share it. So the idea...
Why wouldn't you send it out there with two handles?
I'm sticking with Jim Murray. I'm on Jim Murray's side on this one. Anyway, so why don't they send the Cy Young out here for Leak and Lynn with two straws? Buffering. No, I like that little line. Yeah,
you're really proud of that.
Yeah, it's just funny. It's just funny. I mean, like Leak and Lynn. Like, come on, but they've been really, really fantastic for St. Louis so far.
I mean, I guess if there were two starting pitchers that I would ever think would go to a soda fountain together before a sock hop, it immediately leaps to mind that it would be Lynn and Leak that would go and share a malt.
What's the difference?
A double double with malt, please.
What's the difference between sock hop
like Riverdale
and Sadie Hawkins?
Sadie Hawkins is where the girl asks the guy, and a sock hop is where you wear socks.
Can there be a Sadie Hawkins sock hop?
Absolutely. So, yes.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
All Sadie Hawkins are when the girl asks the guy. Not all sock hops are.
At Clayton High, we called the Sadie Hawkins Pepper's Prom. I never went.
Just for those listening at home, he raised a finger so that I would not talk and create that pause for him to then deliver a joke that we all saw coming. It's like it wasn't enough for him to tip his pitches. He wanted to make us all wait for the pitch that we knew was coming to arrive.
I stand by it.
So as Matheny wrote out the lineup for the final game of the Reds series, the Sunday game against the Reds series, right here in the middle of the homestand, he did something that he had not yet done this season, which was have the same lineup 2 days in a row. This homestand started with him posting a lineup that had a rather significant change to it. Matt Carpenter batting second, right there behind Dexter Fowler, Diaz batting third. That lineup didn't take the field because Matt Carpenter got suspended for bumping, for beaking. That's the official term, beaking. So Fred Bird beaks fans all the time, but now I guess it gets you a one-game suspension if you beak an umpire. That is the two caps coming in contact. So he serves his suspension, and we never saw that lineup again. Yeah. But what we have seen is certainly some continuity to the lineup, especially those first five spots. Do you think that this has some, wait for it, finger up, wait for it, do you think that this has some staying power?
And did you mean because the word power is in there? I think so, man.
You didn't get my hint from the finger?
Oh.
I raised a finger. A joke was coming.
A joke was coming. We need like a flashing sign.
Yeah. The indicator is one finger up. Everything before that, you just ignore. Then one finger up, a joke's coming.
I like it. Thank you, Chris Maloney. I think players like the continuity aspect of it.
Do you like the continuity aspect of it? Do you like the look of this lineup? Are you a believer in Jed Jerko at cleanup?
For now, yeah. For now, I mean, how could I not be? He's hitting three something. He's got four home runs already in the amount of at bats. Right now, I'm with it, but I'm personally, I think over due time, I think a Grichuk or Piscotty's got to claim that spot because that means they'll be doing really well.
How come?
I don't know. I mean, I knew you were going to ask me that. I mean, it just feels right, for lack of a better answer, that especially Grichuk, who's a slugging guy, who's you would presume would hit 25 to 30-ish home runs.
Like Jerko?
Like Jerko did last year, yes. I don't know. I guess I just always presumed that for this OBP engine to continue for the... It would take a Piscotty and Grichuk in the middle of the lineup to drive those dudes in. And now, so that's what we're discussing here. So back to you. Would you be comfortable, do you think it would work out to have a 500 at-bat Jed Jerko batting fourth for St. Louis?
It's the number of the bats that is interesting. What we've seen from him is he's done very well in the situations that they've sort of created for him. Hey, look, this is the spot for you. He's been thrown into incredible starts. We had a lot of traffic going on there. I think that was purposefully loud.
Yeah, no, I mean, just for those, we're in one of the Cardinal offices here in the press box, so when people are coming by getting ready for the big game.
Yeah, most people recognize that we're recording and then go about their business quietly. That was sort of an increased level of action with a purposeful loudness.
Is it possible? Hear me out. That one of our rival podcasts sent that guy in to disrupt our podcast.
The second best podcast in baseball?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm just saying. Can't dismiss that idea.
No, I think it's possible. Also, Trent Rosecrans is in the building from Cincinnati Inquirer, and he is a troublemaker.
There is no question.
Jerko, I think he's done very well at third base. We spent some time talking to Matheny and other folks about, how well he's played at third. Not only just the pickoff, like the awareness of the pickoff that really, tilted the game for Lynn there against Cincinnati on Friday night, where the bases were going to be loaded. He was on tilt. They might have gone to a reliever. Maybe even that played into the decision. Suarez just rounds the base, and Jerko's right there. I mean, he sells it so well. Yeah. Makes the tag, ends the inning. Lynn's out of it. Cardinals win. That kind of savvy is valuable any position. But I think what we're seeing for Jed Jerko at third base, Jedko? That seems kind of... Whatever. Jed Jerko at third base is the fact that that position plays to what he brings best to second base. It's a good first step, and maybe not the complete range of second base, certainly not the range that Wong has a true arm, so stays in there well, turns a good double play. But at third, that first step is all you need. You make a good play, and then he has a true arm, and so that, he and Peralta really have the truest arms of anybody on the infield. So I think that position has really kind of brought out, or maybe maximized some of the traits that that he brings to second base are on display and strengths at third base. But it's that 500 bats that you mentioned. So is he in that range where more is not always more, that at some point in time more becomes less because of the amount of play? I'm not sure we have any evidence of that. I mean, the guy played more and more and more last season, and only one person hit more home runs in the second half than him as he played more and more and more.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure there's an answer to that. He was a full-time player with the San Diego Padres.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm not, you know, talking to Johnny Peralta, who could join the team when the team's in Miami, you know, he was saying, well, I got to find a role on this team now. We'll see what it is. But I'm not going to be the third baseman right off the hop. Look at how great Jed is playing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he unprompted brought that up to us. And, yeah. You know, I don't know. It's just an interesting thing. But when you look at cleanup, and we spent a lot of time in spring training kind of identifying different elements of what could maximize OBP, right?
Mm-hmm.
A guy who strikes out, swings for the fences, pops, you know, hits a lot of fly balls.
Yeah.
We were describing Grichuk because we figured he would be in the starting lineup. Kind of describes Jed too.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, avoid the double plays, right?
Right, right, right. And it's interesting because Grichuk has Jed's been in the bigs longer. So we kind of, some people would look at it like he is what he is. If he's a 400 at bat guy every season, and last year was awesome with the 30 home runs, but that's what a professional or major league Jed Jerko is. Whereas Randall, and I'm guilty of this, and maybe not guilty in a negative way, but I'm like this, where it's like, Randall, how good can he be? Wait till he has a full season again and things like that. What's the ceiling for Randall? Maybe it's higher, but what you said made sense, and the reality is they need a guy in that cleanup spot to not hit in a double plays, and Jed ain't doing it. So, or Jed ain't hitting in a double play, so that's good.
There's an interesting contrast between these topics, right? So Colton Wong batting eighth, it's like, oh, well, he's batting eighth, that's bringing out the best in him. And then the argument you just gave, well, move Grichuk up to fourth, and that will bring out the best in him. You know, there's a contradiction there a little bit, right?
Yes, I suppose. I just think Grichuk has this ceiling where he can be an all-star slugger with 30 plus home runs. So it's like, wouldn't you want that dude to bat fourth?
Maybe when he gets there and he is that dude, that's when he bats fourth.
Right. He has to prove it in the sixth spot or what have you.
Right. Maybe he's the seventh guy. There's no harm in having a guy who bops batting seventh, right?
No, of course not. Of course not, no. Yeah.
You know, I mean, you lengthen the lineup. You have Colton behind him. You know, and also, Piscotty's a really good number five hitter. There are all these kind of lineup dynamic discussions, right? Okay, where should the best hitters be? The best hitters should be, you know, second, first, fourth, and fifth. You know, no, the best hitter is traditionally number three. That's where your best hitter's got to be. You know, you can find an argument to fit whatever you want to do.
Sure.
Now, the data, you know, is pretty strong that the best hitter should be second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is. But whether that works for all lineups, that's the point that Mike Matheny makes. He goes, you know, maybe that doesn't work for a lineup that has these three options for OBP.
Talk about, let's not forget, the Cardinals have a lot of right-handed hitters.
That's a great point.
Yeah, so with Matt, maybe it makes sense to have him third, even if he maybe is your, quote, most ideal second hitter.
Well, it does in the sense that you also avoid the lefty specialist who can come in late in the game and face four consecutive.
Right.
Or, yeah, four consecutive and only have to pitch around a pinch hitter, yeah, because of the lineup chart. That's an excellent point. So, I mean, you do get some balance there when you do it. And so you have Fowler heating up, Aledmus hitting better than his average would suggest or harder than his average suggests, Carpenter with the grand slam, Jerko carving out his cleanup spot, Piscotty, who some folks have described as the kind of prototypical fifth hitter, you know, when you talk about lineup dynamics and all the things he does.
Can you expand on that, both for myself and maybe for some listeners that are curious?
Well, he has the, like you were talking about with Grichuk, he has the ceiling for a high average, right? He hit 20 home runs last year, so he hits damage, good doubles, you know, but also has the ability to get on base. And in that fifth spot, when you think about when is that guy going to be coming up, you know, is he often going to hit with runners on but two outs because of the situation, then who does well in those spots, or what kind of hitter does well in those spots? Well, you know, a guy who throws one out in the gap or hits one in the gap is going to produce a run, two runs. Also a guy who then often starts an inning, so he can be the OBP of getting on base as opposed to the strikeout, the three true outcome kind of guy.
Yeah.
So it's almost like he's a balanced hitter, in the sense that he's probably not going to go out and hit 30 home runs, but he's going to hit 20. He's also probably not going to go and hit 240. He's probably going to hit 290 or higher. So, you know, you kind of have this OPS dynamic where in the fifth spot, you know, it works out really well. The other added benefit is that he runs pretty well, runs the bases pretty well. So you have Molina batting behind him, mm-hmm. and Molina is one of the better hit-and-run guys in the game because he's quite good at making contact.
Yeah.
And we saw that play out. And I thought that, you know, that was very interesting in that series, just the different ways that the Cardinals found to score runs. Some of them were retro. Some of them were how this team has to win. But, you know, Piscotty at one point is on a hit and run, and Matt Adams is at the plate.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Matt Adams told me, I talked to him about this, and he goes, well, you know, in that situation, I'm already down 0-1. He goes, but I wanted to make sure that I let the ball travel a little bit more so that I go behind the runner. And look what happened. I mean, it becomes a run.
Yeah.
That's the kind of execution, the kind of approach, the kind of idea that really powered some of the better runners in scoring position teams of the past few years.
Yeah, and you mentioned runners in scoring position. Talking about Piscotty, that's something that he has done really well in seasons past. So talking about a guy to add on to what we're talking about with the fifth hitter, probably be some guys on base, and he traditionally, statistically, thrives in those scenarios.
I looked at this in the Cardinals Insider for Sunday's paper, this idea that, you know, obviously baseball is going through a change, and you hear the Murphys of the world and, you know, some of these other guys, Chris Bryant's of the world, talking about the value of fly balls. And you and I both talked to Jose Martinez. He brought up the example of watching the video. I know he brought it up specifically about Miguel Cabrera to you. He was talking to me kind of more in more general terms about how they were looking at shortstops and wondering, why are all these guys hitting, you know, ground ball or aren't hitting ground balls,
yeah.
and we are trying. For a long time, you know, this notion of like hit it hard up the middle. You know, I went around and talked to hitters about this idea. You know, they hit it through the pitcher's chest is what you hear a lot, or hit a hard ground ball up the middle, or put it hard somewhere.
Growing up, that's all it was. That was the best hit, right? Hit it through the pitcher. I always remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you hit it through the pitcher, and the second baseman is standing right there. Stephen Piscotty. He said in Milwaukee, he looked up and saw the second baseman behind the pitcher. And the second baseman was like right there, almost like like distracting him. You know, he goes, that's not cool. Yeah, like a free throw. He said, that's not cool. But there he was. He hit a hard ground ball up the middle. I'll never forget when Johnny Peralta came to the Cardinals a few years ago and was working his way through the National League for the first time. They're in Pittsburgh. The Cardinals are in Pittsburgh. They're playing Pittsburgh. And Johnny Peralta hits a smash up the middle. And you see him run towards first base because for his entire life, that he knows that hit has been there for him.
Yeah.
And he starts around in first, and he's thrown out. He's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know, and the look on his face was like, what is going on? And it was, you know, Neil Walker was standing right there up the middle.
Sure.
You know, you go back 10, 11 years, and it was here at this ballpark, and I'm talking to Chipper Jones, and I'm asking him just about, like, hitting philosophy and everything like that. And he goes, look, man, if I wanted to – he was leading the league in batting average ahead of Albert. So we were talking the batting title. And he goes, you know, the batting title's an interesting thing because, he goes, if I wanted to go out there and hit 400, I feel like I could. Is that something I want to chase? He goes, I feel like I could go out there because I know what pitch I can put up the middle for a base hit every time. I can go out and hunt that pitch and poke it up the middle and get a ground ball, 86 hop single that helps my batting average. He goes, but I'm not paid to do that. I'm paid to do damage.
Yeah.
So he said, I'm not looking for that pitch that I can inflate my batting average. I'm looking for that pitch I can put off the wall. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really interesting. Oh, well, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, you're a middle order hitter. You're paid to do damage. Well, now he couldn't even go up the middle. Right, they would, they'd be shifted over.
Right.
And so I think we're seeing, you know, you look around and we're seeing such a proliferation of shifts that I think whenever you talk about a lineup and how it works and how it's put together, or what kind of offense, like what is the identity or characteristics of that offense, you have to take into account how many different ways these days the defense can absolutely eliminate an offense.
And this is a simple point, but we talked about the team that was in town this past week, the Toronto Blue Jays. One of the reasons they were good in recent years was because Josh Donaldson, middle of the lineup, doesn't hit a lot of ground balls. And you wrote about it in your article in Sunday's, The Insider, in Sunday's paper. And it's known around baseball about his ability in that regard. Well, he wasn't in the lineup because he's banged up. And so that's one of the reasons why, what you call the moribund Blue Jays, That's why they're not a ALCS Blue Jays team this year, because they don't have that dude in the middle of the lineup.
Yeah, one of the things we're seeing is just an increase in fly balls all around. And Fangraphs described it as that the baseball is leaking towards being a three true outcome game. Three true outcomes being a walk, a strikeout, or a home run. You see more and more that hitters are trying, or at least some hitters are trying to hit fly balls. You know, as Clint Hurdle told his team this past spring, you know, your OPS is in the air. Josh Donaldson took to Twitter and said, just say no to ground balls. And there's this whole, you know, there's the whole quote-unquote ground ball suck movement.
And Daniel Murphy, who you mentioned earlier in the podcast, he had a cool quote I read. I believe it was an MLB.com story where he said, it's kind of like with this new data and exit velocity and things like that, we kind of have the answers to the test. And I liked that quote from him.
That's a good quote.
Where he's saying, they're figuring out ways where they can get the fly balls and not hit the ground balls against opponents, because these shifts are gobbling up hits.
So John Mabry says it's not that anything has changed, it's that the communication and the discussion has changed. His point was, we now have phrases and data to make the point to hitters that we've always tried to teach. And that was what Murphy's talking about, what Brian's talking about, it's what Ted Williams tried to describe, except for Ted Williams didn't have exit velocity and launch angles to make his point. But he was trying to make this point as well. You got to hit with a little lift because, look, we can look at this, right? Okay, so the Cardinals in 2016, on ground balls, they hit 240 and they slugged 258 on ground balls, slugged 258. On fly balls, they hit 248, so not all that different, right? They slugged 762.
Right.
You know, all right, 2017, again, it's your small sample size argument. On ground balls, they're hitting 231 with a slugging percentage of 243, so very narrow gap there. On fly balls, 259, slugging 701. I mean, their OPS on fly balls is 953, 500 points higher.
Yeah.
I mean, your OPS is in the air. It's how often will the pitcher let you do that? How often can you do it? But also, this is a key question. So what is your trade-off? And baseball is seeing fewer and fewer and fewer balls put in play because there are more strikeouts, because there are more and less action, because a fly ball is a little different than a ground ball, right? As far as action goes, unless
St. Louis, we had Ozzie Smith for all those years. I mean, it was fun. Part of the entertainment aspect of watching baseball was watching the infielders challenged by these hits.
Right. And a good lineup is going to have a lot of different ways to score, a lot of different ways that it can score. But if you have all these guys hitting fly balls, I was talking to Jerko about it, I'm like, it sounds like fewer and fewer teams are going to manufacture runs. If teams are trying to find their OPS in the air, they're not testing the infielders, not moving runners over. They're not doing the things that in some ways the Cardinals have to do to be successful. You know, you're not going to hit three fly balls, and to quote Jed Jerko, he goes, you're not going to hit three fly balls and miraculously have a run.
Right.
You know, you might walk and hit three ground balls and have a run. You know, so the manufacturing is vanishing from the game. Do you think that's a realistic kind of dot, those dots that I'm connecting, you think that's realistic? feasible?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. I see the points. I just the question is there a way to combat it? I mean, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, did people think that the shifts in the infield would affect the game the way they are today? Is there something that could happen in the future, whether it's a type of pitch, whether it's the way you position your out?
20 years ago.
Go ahead.
You mean with shifts?
Yeah.
Here, just 5 years ago, the Cardinals had 72 plate appearances with shifts.
Okay.
Total. Total. This month, they have 107.
Golly. Yeah, there it is.
So 20 years ago, you know, shifts were like for, you know, the slugging left-handed hitter who, you know, right, ambled up to the dugout and, you know, kind of like Clu Hayward spit out tobacco,
right,
you know, and they're like, well, that's the guy we have to shift on.
Sure.
Now it's Watson in the dugout saying, you know, this is a guy you have to shift, you know, approximately 3 microns to the left. And, you know, the interesting part about it, like Piscotty described this to me, he goes, they're shifting me for how I hit the ball when I hit it the best. Mm-hmm. He goes, so I'm getting hits on miss hits.
Right.
How do I even practice miss hits?
Right.
Like, how do I practice miss hits?
Yeah.
No, you work so hard to try to make hard contact and drive the ball.
Right.
He goes, and now the computer is like, yep, stand right there.
Right, right. Do what you don't want to do, and you'll be successful. So, and that's why I said, who knows the answer, how they'll combat this at some point, whether it's types of pitches, whether it's outfield shifts, what have you. We don't know, but yeah, the game is changing in front of our eyes, and the Cardinals are at least adapting to it. As
are they?
Well, as you wrote about in your pieces, they're trying to learn how to not hit in the double plays and such.
Right, but it's costing them success with runners in scoring position.
True.
I mean, you look at this team,
yeah,
and look how it scores runs. Doesn't it need action to score runs?
Well, but they're going to get the guys on base. A lot of that's with walks.
Sure, and then they stand there waiting for a fly ball. I'm a little confused as to what the identity of this offense ought to be.
What would you say? How would you take all these things we've mentioned in the podcast and put it together to create an opportunistic identity?
I don't know. You're the columnist. You figure it out.
You cover the team. You're basically on the. You basically know what Mozeliak knows.
I mean, I think that's where they're at. I think they're trying to figure that out. Like, you know, you can put 4 guys on base, and you know one is going to come home if they all walk, right? That's there are only 3 bases before somebody has to come home.
Right.
But I think this is a little bit of a mix of a team, but that's why the lineup discussion is so valuable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you have a guy who you have these 2 hitters in Fowler and Carpenter who work counts and you can separate them and they can do a lot of different things offensively, then you have a guy like Aledmys Diaz and Piscotty who might be the most well-rounded hitters that they have. And then you have these 2 like boppers in Jerko, mm-hmm, and Grichuk. There's a lot of arguments that you don't put the 2 like batters together.
Okay.
And that's what we've kind of seen develop over this time. You have the guy who works for the OBP,
mm-hmm,
works the count, can go first to third, you know, can go second home, can score from first on a double,
mm-hmm,
batting leadoff. You got the guy who hits doubles, who does damage, who is rounding into a more complete hitter, batting second. Then you come back with a guy who grinds. Then you come up with a guy who reaches for the fences.
Mm-hmm.
Then you come back with a guy who's more a complete hitter. Then you follow him up with a contact guy. Then you come in with a bopper who might strike out. Then you come in with a Wong,
yeah,
who is showing more patience and willing to take a walk, but can also hit a triple,
yeah,
that then leads you to go, gosh, Lee, I got to walk the other bases loaded,
yeah,
and then Carpenter hits a grand slam.
Right, but are you saying that change of pace, if you will, not having the 2 of the same back-to-back can benefit?
It might be the way they work, because the hard ground balls and, you know, the ground balls with runners in scoring position, the base running isn't there. You know, I'll give you for example, okay? So, like, in talking with Jerko's like, you know, a guy like Fowler can be very valuable when you talk about a type of offense, especially if you get guys in the air, because he can start on first, steal second, and then two fly balls get him home.
Right?
Okay. Or he can start on first, steal second, maybe steal third, and then a fly ball gets him home. Right? As opposed to start on first, hit a ground ball, and watch it become a double play because, oh, by the way, they're just shifted right there.
Yeah.
You know, he said you start to see the value of sort of the athleticism that can manufacture runs without the ball being put in play.
But how many stolen bases really is Dexter going to get?
No, and this is the qualm, and this is the question that I'm bringing up. Is like, it's like they have to be all of these things. So it's the clockwork argument, right?
Ah, that was a good podcast, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Thanks.
Clockwork red.
So, you know, it's like, well, what do they want to be identity-wise, and what are we learning from their from their lineup? Yeah. And what can we see? I mean, look, in the first game of the doubleheader, right, they rallied with what? Fly balls. Home runs, Grichik, a fly ball, triple, grand slam, you know, Matt Carpenter. The next game, they go 1-for-15 with runners in scoring position. They still win, in part because in two innings, they got runners going. And they recognized that that pitcher was slow to the plate, was giving them a chance to take some jumps, giving them a chance to do some hit and runs, giving them a chance that other pitchers aren't, but so they could get guys in motion. They could make things happen. They didn't have to produce with runners in scoring position all that often because they were getting both damage and runners going. And, you know, key ground outs, they had a sacrifice fly when they needed it. They had a ground out that drove in a run when they needed it. These kind of things. So we see, like, even in that doubleheader, a blended approach. And what struck me is you go back to 2013 when they were just bonkers. No team ever hit with runners in scoring position possibly like they did then.
Yeah.
Talking to Charlie Manuel, he said one of the things that they've done really well or did really well in 2013 was they hit to the left of the shortstop. They got everything in motion. They created holes in the defense, and then they hit to the left of the shortstop. He goes, that's where success is with runners in scoring position. He goes, you have to be willing to put the ball in play. You have to have hitters who are willing to put the ball in play. You know what isn't happening in today's game?
Hitting to that spot anymore because there's a dude standing there.
Or putting the ball in play. It's like that style of success with runners doesn't work. And, you know, and I brought this up in the story, and I'll bring it up here on the podcast as we bring this to a close, is, you know, the Cardinals went 9-for-20 against Manuel's Phillies team in that series. You know, most of all those hits were to the left of shortstop. I believe like six, it was in the story, six of them were on the ground up the middle, where now you're finding a fielder.
Yeah.
You know, you look back to that 1-for-15 runners in scoring position, 10 outs on the ground. You can kind of see, I mean, it's anecdotal, it's small sample size, it's all that you want to bring up, but you can kind of see how, look, man, defense is now getting to a point where it's never been this hard to hit. Pitchers are throwing harder. Right. Relievers are coming in that are paid a lot to get that one guy out.
Yeah, specialist aspect. I mean, my goodness gracious. Yeah.
And now defenses are swallowing you whole, any ground ball. So hitters have to adjust, and the Cardinals have to find a sweet spot in a lineup that produces runs, because this much is true for this team. It's going to be playing a lot of close games. This is not a bomber team like last year's team, and they don't want it to be.
Right.
It has to be a pesky, relentless, ongoing team that, yes, has some extra bases in it, has some slugging in it, has some guys who are going to be focused on the flyout, but it's got to have a lot of different ways to score runs if it's going to contend.
Yeah. I guess my final question to you, Derek, is let's say you were 10 years old. You're excited. You go to the Cardinal game in 1987. You get a free seat cushion. It's got the Cardinal logo on it. And her hits the grand slam. Does 10-year-old Derek throw it on the field, or do you take it home to have?
Ooh, that's a really good question. Buffering. Buffering. Buffering.
Well, it could be a cliffhanger. Tune in next time to find out what 10-year-old Derek would have done with the seat cushion in 1987.
You've been listening to the best podcast in baseball.
I bailed you out.
Thanks for listening to the best podcast in baseball. You can always find the best podcast in baseball on iTunes, Stitchers, and pretty much anywhere now that you can get your podcast, wherever you want to go. On iTunes, you can listen to individual episodes. You can download individual episodes. Or, please do this, you can subscribe to the podcast in general and get little alerts when a new episode comes up. Yeah. And we'll have new episodes coming up. We're doing this better.
Yeah, yeah. No, Derek is obviously the captain of our team here and does a terrific job. It's just fun being a co-host with you on this, and I love just being part of the community. And I'm telling you, man, every week I go out, somebody comes up to me and they're like, BPIB, or when's the next BPIB? Like, it's people are listening, and I just want you all to know that I and Derek truly, truly appreciate it.
Hopefully you also enjoy the better sound quality. We are working on that. We saw your reviews on iTunes. I pay attention to them. Do you pay attention?
I read the ones on Stitcher.
Oh, okay. I'm sure they complain about the sound quality is too, so we're trying to work on that. You can find Benjamin's work, my work, on stltoday.com. In Sunday's paper, we had approximately 190 inches of baseball coverage, and there wasn't even a pitch thrown the day before. So
that's it. I mean, we talk about St. Louis as a baseball town. You were tweeting it earlier. That captures it. I mean, I bet we had more baseball coverage in our paper than any of the cities that have Major League Baseball, and we didn't have a game here in St. Louis.
There was no game.
Yeah. But it was good stuff, though. It was neat stuff. It was look backs, look forwards, melding the past and the present. You got some news in there about products. I'm pretty proud to be part of this baseball coverage for the Post-Dispatch.
Yeah, in the Post-Dispatch, in that notebook, it talked about how Trevor Rosenthal has thrown the third fastest pitch in baseball this year. 102 miles an hour.
That's not bad.
First, second, third, and fourth are all Aroldis Chapman.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Here's the fun part. Ready? Ready for it?
Yes.
Two of those have been against the Cardinals.
Oh, man.
So,
yeah.
Five fastest pitches in baseball. Two of them the Cardinals have seen. A third the Cardinals threw. So, until next time, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould for St. Louis Post-Dispatch, stltoday.com, sports comms, Benjamin Hockman. You've been listening to the best podcast in baseball, and we'll talk to you next week, if not sooner.
I mean, here we are in... Now we're back at our seats. Two runners
wild
on.
Pitch.
Who's up? Piscotty. And wild pitch. Got a runner. It's almost as if you know what you're talking about, Derek.
Almost. You know what? I'd probably keep the seat cushion.
Really?
Well, why would you want it? What?
I don't know.
What good is a seat cushion? You have cushions already at your house.
You said 10-year-old me. First of all, 10-year-old me at a baseball game, that didn't exist, so I don't know.
Yeah, you don't have anything to...
I mean, 10-year-old me at a Major League Baseball game would have been thrilled. I mean, at 10, I hadn't yet seen a Major League game. I'd seen outside a Major League stadium.
Yeah, you grew up in Denver, in the Denver era, so you would have taken anything you could from
I probably would have kept a hot dog wrapper from my first, at 10.
That's fair. I would have thrown the hell out of my seat cushion.
Oh, so it would have hit the guy in front of you?
No. Actually, maybe not in front of me, a couple rows in front of you. That's a good point. Trajectory would have been key on that. You know what? It's
launch angle.
Launch angle is a theme of the podcast. You want to throw a low throw? You gotta get the seat cushion in the air. You
gotta have launch angle for your seat cushion.
Yeah.
Stat cast on seat cushion. Make it happen.
Love it.